Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Bob Doty reporting. Islamic State claims responsibility for suicide blasts at mosques in Yemen. A group claiming to be a Yemeni branch of the Islamic State has claimed responsibility for suicide bombings in Yemen that killed at least 126 people at mosques used by supporters of Shiite rebels. The group posted an online statement Friday vowing to carry out more attacks on Shiite Houthis. At least three suicide bombers blew themselves up around the time of midday prayers Friday at the Badr and al-Hashush mosques in the capital Sana'a. Those mosques are linked to the Houthi Shiite rebel group that controls Sana'a. More than 250 people were wounded. U.S. President Barack Obama has told Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu he will reassess aspects of the U.S.-Israeli relationship after the Israeli leader's comments rejecting the two-state solution. Mr. Obama delivered the message Thursday during a phone call to congratulate Mr. Netanyahu on his election victory this week, according to a White House official. On Thursday, Prime Minister Netanyahu told several U.S. media outlets he does not object to a demilitarized Palestinian state, but added that is not achievable at the current time. At least 11 people have died in the Nigerian border town of Gamboru in an apparent attack by the Boko Haram militant group, which had ceded the territory to Cameroonian forces a few weeks ago. The attack near the border with Cameroon underscores the tension in northern Nigeria as the country prepares for what appears will be a closely contested election on March 28th. This is VOA News. Speaking a year after Russia's annexation of Crimea, U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Samantha Power, told VOA that Crimea is and will remain part of Ukraine.
The United States will never recognize Russia's attempted annexation of Ukraine. Sanctions that were put in place because of Crimea against Russia will remain in place for as long as Russia tries to sustain this illegality. And above all, our hearts go out to the people of Crimea who have suffered terribly in the wake of this aggression.
She said the sham referendum last March was not recognized by 100 UN member states in a UN vote. Japanese police said Friday they have arrested a man who threatened to bomb the U.S. Embassy in Tokyo. Police say Okinawa resident Mitsuyoshi Kamiya made phone calls threatening to bomb the embassy as well as Camp Schwab, a U.S. military base on the southern Japanese island. Local media report the 52-year-old Kamiya is also believed to be behind recent death threats against U.S. Ambassador Carolyn Kennedy and other American diplomatic officials. On Thursday, U.S. State Department spokeswoman Jen Psaki said Japanese police arrested a man in connection with the threats against both the embassy and the ambassador. New research on global arms trading shows China, with the world's second-largest economy, surpassing Germany to become the world's third-largest arms exporter. A report from the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute shows nearly 70% of those weapons sales went to Pakistan, Bangladesh, and Myanmar. Beijing also supplied weaponry to 18 African nations as its sales rose by 143% between 2005 and 2014. Overall, global sales rose 16% in the past 5 years. The report shows the U.S. as the leading arms exporter, with sales rising by 23% over the past decade. U.S. sales accounted for 31% of all exports between 2010 and 2014, followed by Russia with 27%. Skygazers near the Arctic Circle were treated to a perfect view of a total solar eclipse Friday as the moon completely blocked out the sun in a clear sky, casting a shadow over Norway's remote archipelago of Svalbard. A partial solar eclipse could be seen across Europe and also parts of Asia and Africa. The total eclipse, the last total eclipse, was in November 2012 over Australia. The next one will be over Indonesia in March of 2016. That's the news. I'm Bob Doty in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiyis Wuhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
The World Health Organization is calling for an urgent scaling up of routine vaccinations in Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone. It says while those countries continue efforts to end the Ebola outbreak, there is a growing risk of measles, pertussis, and other preventable diseases.
That's reporter Jody Kapawai in Washington. Details coming up.
Also, internal memos from the World Health Organization reveal that some of the reasons the international agency failed to declare the Ebola outbreak a crisis for more than 4 months were political considerations.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Burkina Faso, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, medical officials say about 100 people were killed and more than 150 wounded when three suicide bombers blew themselves up at a pair of mosques in Yemen's capital Sana'a. The attacks took place around the time of midday prayers Friday at the Badr and Al-Hashush mosques, which are associated with the Houthi Shiite rebel group that controls Sana'a. Another suicide bomber attacked amid the panicked crowds. There has been no claim of responsibility.
The Houthi rebels are loyal to former Yemeni leader Ali Abdullah Saleh. They engaged yesterday in fierce gun battles in the southern city of Aden with a militia loyal to current president Abdurrabu Mansour Hadi. Four pro-Saleh fighters and two militiamen were killed in the clashes. Mr. Hadi last month escaped house arrest by the Houthi rebels, who were allied with Mr. Saleh, the longtime leader who was ousted in a 2011 popular uprising. Mr. Hadi fled to Aden in a bid to re-establish his authority in the politically fractured nation. The United Nations, Arab Gulf nations, and several Western countries, including the United States, have all issued statements supporting Mr. Hadi.
Nigeria's president, Goodluck Jonathan, says he hopes all territory now occupied by the Islamist militants of Boko Haram will be recovered in 1 month. Jonathan faces a tough re-election bid on March 28th. The outcome may be heavily influenced by last-minute military efforts to take back large portions of the northeastern provinces from Boko Haram. More than 10,000 people have died in a bloody six-year Boko Haram campaign to forge a caliphate in Borno, Adamawa, and Yobe states. This week, the Nigerian military claims it has retaken all but three governorates in Borno State. A regional force of Chad, Niger, and Cameroon troops have focused on communities on Lake Chad and Nigeria's borders. Chad military officials today report they found a mass grave in Damasek, a Nigerian town on the Niger border, where they defeated Boko Haram forces several days ago. They are waiting for Nigerian officials to investigate. Boko Haram occupies the town for 4 months. The Chad spokesman reports they found the town deserted. Residents of another Nigerian town, Gamboru, report that Boko Haram gunmen killed 11 residents on the outskirts of the town Wednesday evening. At the sound of gunfire, Cameroon troops arrived and drove the militants out. Gamboru is a market town on the Cameroon border.
And a small test using female community health workers in conservative northern Nigeria found that women and children were much more likely to use health services there than in areas where they had to see a male nurse. Health reporter R. Chimes has the details.
Seeing women as community health workers was a pretty radical change for conservative, predominantly Muslim areas of northern Nigeria,
where indeed most women are not expected to be living on their own, providing health care essentially 24/7, or riding around meeting with families in the scattered hamlets.
Dr. Sally Findlay of Columbia University's Mailman School of Public Health in New York is co-author of a new study that examined the feasibility of assigning women to work in remote, traditional areas of Nigeria. The country has one of the world's highest death rates of women connected with pregnancy and childbirth, and northern Nigeria is worse off than most of the rest of the country. Male health workers travel from town to town, but many women won't see a man for such personal issues. Speaking via Skype, Finley said the pilot study in Jigawa State required extensive community involvement and buy-in from religious leaders, even on such matters as transportation arrangements.
We had to get permission from the state imam, the leader of all the Muslims in Jigawa, to have these female-friendly motorcycles and give permission for them to use them.
The new women health workers were apparently a hit in their community. There were five times more visits to the health center after the women arrived than before.
Yes, in fact, they did like this, and it did change their understanding of what they could get if they went to the facility for care.
What they could get included round-the-clock access to trained health workers, women who could handle normal births and refer complex cases to a hospital, and even assistance with family planning. Two health workers were assigned to a facility. That way, one could be out on home visits while the other was available to provide walk-in services. The positive results of the Nigerian pilot study have prompted state officials in Jigawa to expand the program of women community health workers. A paper describing the program by Sally Finley and her co-authors is published in the journal Global Health, Science and Practice. For VOA News, this is Art Chimes reporting.
Coming up on 12 Minutes Past the Hour, this is Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Ethiopia today publicly destroyed its entire stockpile of ivory, which included an estimated 6.1 tons of raw tusks, carvings, trinkets, and jewelry. The burning took place at the Gulele Botanical Garden in Addis Ababa. The African Wildlife Foundation, AWF, commends the government for taking a public stand in its fight to save its remaining elephant population. Ethiopia is a key trafficking and source hub for the illegal trade of ivory, with its major international airport and an elephant population of around 1,800. Kathleen Kerrigan is the Senior Communications and Media Relations Officer for the African Wildlife Foundation. She spoke with me about the significance of the Horn of Africa's first ivory burn.
I think it was pretty significant. This is the first time ivory has been destroyed in the Horn of Africa. Addis Ababa, the capital city of Ethiopia, is the seat of the African Union. So I think it's very important that this message of zero tolerance for elephant poaching, for ivory trafficking, that it comes from Addis. And I think that sends a very strong message to the rest of the continent. And like so many countries that have also embarked on this path and destroyed their stockpiles of ivory, it's a statement by the government that they recognize the issue, that they directly link ivory trade to elephant poaching, and that they are serious about cracking down on both.
I understand that it was an estimated 6.1 tons of raw tusks and other ivory pieces that were burned. Did this come from after making arrests?
Most of the ivory that was burned today, and it includes raw tusks, carvings, jewelry, chopsticks, most of this was confiscated ivory. This was ivory that was being smuggled through the country and mostly through the major airport there in Addis. So it was smuggled ivory. In large part, a lot of it was coming from other parts of the continent, other African countries, though some of it was most certainly from Ethiopia's own elephant population.
How many people have been arrested so far in Ethiopia regarding the trafficking of ivory?
Since 2010, there have been an estimated a little more than 730 arrests in the country. Just last year, there were a little over 100 arrests. And the majority of those arrests were made at the international airport, people who were trying to ferry ivory, you know, from other parts of the continent, from Ethiopia out of Africa. They were arrested there. And in large part, the majority of them were foreigners, many of Chinese nationality.
Have they actually been convicted and are they imprisoned?
There have been, yeah, a few, and I think that's an area that a lot of African countries and countries around the world, for that matter, are trying to strengthen, is that it's not really enough to make the arrest, that there really needs to be a system of handing down punitive sentences to those convicted of their crimes. And that's something that Ethiopia, per the Ivory Action Plan that it released last year, recognizes and is trying to tackle. They want to do a thorough analysis of their wildlife laws, amend those where they need to be amended, and then take steps to, you know, ensure that the laws are being enforced by law enforcement, by the judiciary in the country.
So what is their next step from here in attempts to continue to thwart this poaching?
Their next steps are really going to be strengthening the capacity of the wildlife authority there, the Ethiopian Wildlife Conservation Authority, in dealing with this issue. A lot of wildlife agencies are underfunded and undermanned to really address the problem. And they've started to do that. They are adding rangers to that force, and they're in that process now. And then working with conservation groups, other non-governmental organizations, and other governments. They're not only sending the message with the burning of ivory, but they're also sending a message through handing down punitive sentences that they really do have zero tolerance for this, and that Ethiopia will not be a safe haven for ivory traffickers or elephant poachers, and that it will no longer be a key transit hub for trafficked ivory.
Do you think the international community recognizes just how serious poaching is to the elephant population for Africa?
Definitely. The international community is very aware and very mobilized right now to address this issue. And that's a great sign, because that's really what happened in the 1980s when we had our previous poaching wars and elephant populations were in decline across the continent. And as soon as the international community mobilized and a number of countries got on board and there was a lot of public attention to the issue, that's when we had the international ban on the international trade in ivory in 1989. And after that, you saw a significant decline in the trade in illegal ivory, and you saw an increase and a stabilization of elephant populations in Africa. So that's what we're seeing again here, is this mobilization of public awareness and action and resources toward addressing this issue. And it's pulling in actors from all parts of the world, from China to the U.S. to Ethiopia to Gabon to the Philippines. Everybody is mobilizing around this issue.
That was Kathleen Garrigan, Senior Communications and Media Relations Officer for the African Wildlife Foundation. She spoke with me from Washington, D.C.
Internal memos from the World Health Organization reveal that some of the reasons the international agency failed to declare the Ebola outbreak a crisis for more than 4 months were political considerations. The Associated Press Wire Service reports that despite the urging of African division staff in their Geneva offices, a June internal memo to WHO Director Margaret Chan warned that countries facing the epidemic might consider such a declaration a hostile act. However, as early as March 25th, WHO Ebola expert Jean Bosco Ndihokubwa called the outbreak the tip of an iceberg in a "We Need Support" email. The AP investigation identifies other staff warnings of an impending disaster. Other health agencies, such as Doctors Without Borders, had also urged the WHO declare a health emergency in the three West African countries. Dr. Chan declared an emergency on August 8th after an estimated 1,000 people had died of the Ebola virus. Chan has since then admitted the agency was slow to act. Following criticism of WHO bureaucratic process and the agency's regional office in Africa had been slow to act, the regional director for Africa, Dr. Louis Sambo, left the position in October. Bruce Aylward, a WHO epidemiologist who was tapped to lead the agency's Ebola response in October, says it is not possible to know if an earlier response would have made any difference.
The agency had other concerns when the virus began to spread in West Africa. A senior scientist at a June 2nd meeting warned that the WHO was overwhelmed by efforts to combat a polio outbreak and Middle Eastern respiratory syndrome. As of last week, more than 10,000 died of the epidemic in Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea. The number of new cases has plummeted in most areas of these countries, but Guinea and Sierra Leone continue to find some new infections. In Sierra Leone, the National Ebola Response Center announced that next week, residents of a few communities identified as hotspots of the virus will be told to stay in their houses for 3 days. Between May 27th and 29th, health workers will conduct a house-to-house search for possible infections. In Liberia, where there have been no new infections in more than 2 weeks, the government will offer a $5,000 grant to the families of any health workers who died fighting the virus. More than 180 health workers died of the virus. 11 families have received the grants and more are being processed. The funds came from a World Bank grant.
The World Health Organization is calling for an urgent scaling up of routine vaccinations in Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone. It says, while those countries continue efforts to end the Ebola outbreak, there is a growing risk of measles, pertussis, and other preventable diseases. VOA's Jody Kapua reports.
The Ebola-affected countries have not been able to keep up with routine medical care for more than a year. Health systems were initially overwhelmed by the outbreak. Then, with international help, services were targeted toward stopping the spread of the disease, which has killed more than 10,000 people. WHO spokesman Daniel Epstein says health officials are especially worried about a potential measles epidemic.
Measles is one of the most contagious diseases in the world, very easily spread from one kid to another. And it can be deadly not only for children under 5, but also for adults over 20 who haven't been vaccinated. It has a number of additional side effects, especially in a child who is malnourished or has other health problems, can cause death.
It's estimated nearly 146,000 people died from measles in 2013, most of them children under age 5.
So that's about 400 deaths a day. Most of them are from complications associated with the disease, and it can cause blindness. It can cause encephalitis, which is an infection that causes brain swelling. Measles can cause severe diarrhea and dehydration, or even respiratory infections like pneumonia.
The WHO says prior to widespread vaccinations, there were more than 2.5 million deaths from measles each year. Epstein says some vaccination programs are already underway in the Ebola-affected countries.
It's already started. Liberia has already begun 2 rounds of immunization. Guinea, in November and December of last year, began vaccination activities in Ebola-free provinces.
Because the health systems were so hard hit by Ebola, Epstein says special care is being taken to administer routine vaccinations.
So what we are working on is dividing it up into zones. Where there are districts that are free of Ebola, routine vaccination will restart. And where there are areas where there are still Ebola cases, they will take special measures to vaccinate people, not in a mass campaign because we don't want to have a mass gathering, but in door-to-door campaigns and with special precautions.
Besides routine preventable diseases, the World Health Organization has also stepped up anti-malaria efforts this year.
Malaria, of course, is a very serious health problem. We have now good drugs against malaria, and we've done a couple of rounds of mass drug administration to prevent malaria because it's one of the ways that we can help the countries do early recovery. And we estimate that we've reached about 3 million people with door-to-door distribution of malaria drugs.
The WHO spokesman says malaria and Ebola both produce high fevers. He says treating malaria patients will help prevent them from being mistaken for having Ebola. Epstein emphasizes that anti-Ebola efforts will continue in Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone until it's confirmed all three countries have 0 new cases. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
A climate initiative in the Catholic Church has engaged more than 50 countries in a fast for the planet. As VOA's Roseanne Skirbel reports, while it is common for Catholics to fast in the days leading up to Easter, the Lenten fast for climate justice is calling on all people of faith to fast both from food and fossil fuels that are warming the planet.
Each day for 40 days, a different country takes up the call. The United States is the 25th nation to join the fast, which in Washington was a prayer vigil on the grounds of the U.S. Capitol.
Let us pray. Give us humble and open hearts, O Lord our God, to listen to your word and to put it into practice.
Theologians and lay activists from different faiths join the vigil to take a stand on climate change as a moral, ethical, and spiritual issue. Patrick Carolyn is executive director of the Franciscan Action Network, the grassroots group that organized the event.
As people of faith, we have to protect and care for God's creation. And so we're hoping that our legislators will start paying attention. So that's kind of what we're hoping to do, is get our leaders, our faith leaders, our priests and our rabbis to start speaking from the pulpits with their prophetic voices and talking about how this is the most important issue.
Rabbi David Schneer took that pulpit today with his hand in a fist over his heart. He says it's a Jewish tradition during Yom Kippur, the Holy Fast Day, to ask for forgiveness from sins. Here, it's a sign for action.
Kind of like knocking on the door of our hearts, to open our hearts. That's one way some people do it, as kind of like to afflict oneself. You know, like, I really should be hurting because of all the transgressions I've done.
Others followed as the rabbi read a list of wrongs against the earth.
For the wrong of filling land and ocean with filth, toxins, and garbage. And for the wrong of extinguishing forever wondrous species which you saved from the waters of the flood. And for the wrong.
Next, the Reverend Lennox Yearwood stepped before the crowd, wearing a black cap that read "Die Vest." It was a reminder of the threat that fossil fuels play in warming the planet. In spirited remarks, he argued that climate skeptics could be a catalyst for positive change.
So on this day, I call upon all the climate deniers, because you can actually be the rock in which this movement can be built upon. How amazing will it be when Southern Republicans, when they are saying that climate change is real, how amazing will it be when those who are denied over and over are now saying that the time is now to fight climate change?
Reverend Yearwood says it's not only the politicians who must act, but each and every one of us.
Because the work of all of us, Republican and Democrat, black and white, male and female, and they will rise up and they will say that we are fossil free at last. Fossil free at last. Thank God Almighty, we are fossil free at last.
The vigil ended with a contemplative moment as each person scattered a handful of fresh dirt on the Capitol grounds. Patrick Carolyn hopes the symbolic gesture will sow the seeds of change.
The whole earth is at stake, and we have a very short period of time. Years ago, we talked about sustainability, and then we talked about adaptability, and now we're talking about survivability. And so everything is at stake.
The Lenten Fast for Climate Justice is part of a 365-day fast for the climate. The young people, environmentalists, and people of faith in the global movement have been fasting one day a month since December to bring attention to climate change. The campaign will culminate this coming December at the summit in Paris, where world leaders hope to sign a new treaty to address global warming. Roseanne Scherbel, VOA News, Washington.
This is African News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehi Yisroohib in Washington. It's 29 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Nigeria heads to the polls March 28th for a landmark election. What happens there matters throughout Africa. Turn to Voice of America for the facts. VOA reporters are in Nigeria and surrounding countries covering the campaigns and the issues and counting down to the March 28th election and beyond. Special Nigeria Decides 2015 coverage is underway now. A commitment to Africa from Voice of America.
Celebrate the sounds of Africa today, yesterday, and tomorrow. That's our mission in your show, Music Time in Africa. Hello, I'm your host, Heather Maxwell.
Join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC and discover the best Pan-African music in the world. We play it all right here. Only the best on VOA Africa.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Medical officials say about 100 people were killed and more than 150 wounded when three suicide bombers blew themselves up at a pair of mosques in Yemen's capital. And internal memos from the World Health Organization reveal that some of the reasons the international agency failed to declare the Ebola outbreak a crisis for more than 4 months were political considerations. Coming up, we'll have music from Burkina Faso. And in our feature segment, in northeast Nigeria, Boko Haram has distributed leaflets warning people to boycott the March 28th nationwide elections. I'm Kim Lewis with Yehias Wuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. Of course, it's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young, and happy Friday, Sunny.
Happy Friday, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand an Australian cricket victory tops your sports report today.
Kim, Australia beat visiting Pakistan by 6 wickets Friday to advance to the semifinals of the Cricket World Cup. Pakistan's batsmen were bowled out for 213 at Adelaide Oval. Shane Watson and Glenn Maxwell built an unbeaten 68-run partnership to power the Aussies to victory. The World Cup co-hosts reeled in the final runs with over 16 overs to spare. Watson was unbeaten on 64 and Maxwell 44 not out. Australia's victory sets up what should be a sensational semifinal against defending champion India March 26th in Sydney. Australia's captain, Michael Clarke, says his team will need to be in top form to beat India and make it to the final.
Every win gives you momentum and gives you confidence, and this will certainly be exactly the same. I think, obviously, India are a completely different opposition to Pakistan. They have different strengths, also different weaknesses as well, so we need to assess them. I think they're obviously playing a lot better than they were throughout the start of the summer. And I said that leading into the World Cup, that I thought India were going to be an extremely tough team to beat, just because, well, obviously because they're a very good team, but because they've spent so much time in Australia as well, they know the conditions quite well. So, you know, the game on Thursday is going to certainly be a challenge, and I say it all the time, but we're definitely going to have to beat our best to beat them.
Australia's cricket captain, Michael Clarke, commenting on what it's going to take to topple defending champion India next week. And Michael was talking in Adelaide, Australia. The other Cricket World Cup semifinal will be played March 24th in Auckland, New Zealand. The Proteas of South Africa await the winner of Saturday's quarterfinal between New Zealand and the West Indies in Wellington. And this Sunny Side of Sports correction, I said on Wednesday and Thursday how this marks the first time South Africa has reached the World Cup semifinals. In fact, the Proteas have done it on 3 previous occasions, 1992, 1999, and 2007. The South Africans have never advanced to the World Cup final, though, and team captain A.B. de Villiers says the big goal is to lift the trophy on March 29th in Melbourne, Australia. In African youth football, Senegal will host Nigeria in Sunday's African Under-20 final in the capital, Dakar. The Flying Eagles of Nigeria are bidding for their record-extending 7th African Under-20 Championship, and I'm picking them to win on Sunday. In fact, some of my Nigerian friends might have seen my appearance Thursday evening on Channel TV's Sports Tonight program. My friend Toyin Ibitoye, the Sports Tonight presenter, put me on the spot and asked me to make a prediction ahead of Sunday's African Under-20 final. I gazed into my crystal soccer ball and told Toyin, Nigeria 3, Senegal 1. Coincidentally, that was also the score when the teams met in the group stage. The Senegalese boys reached the final with a 2-1 win over Mali. Our Daybreak Africa sportsman Marco Uma has that story as well as other football news.
Senegalese striker Moussa Kone scored in each half, while midfielder Alassane Diallo replied for Mali as hosts Senegal edged Mali 2-1 in semi-final action at the Africa Under-20 Championships in Dakar on Thursday. This is the first time a Senegalese team has reached the finals of an African tournament since the 2002 Orange Africa Cup of Nations, where they were runners-up to Cameroon. On Sunday, Mali played Ghana in the bronze medal playoff, then Senegal challenged Nigeria in the final. Nigeria beat Senegal 3-1 during the group stage of the competition. Meanwhile, South Africa host Madagascar in the Africa Beach Soccer qualifiers tomorrow Saturday. On Sunday, Ghana welcome Uganda, Ivory Coast play Mauritius, Egypt face Tanzania as Madagascar and South Africa clash for the second time in 2 days. In Switzerland, France will stage the 2019 FIFA Women's World Cup, FIFA announced in Zurich on Thursday. Initially, England, New Zealand, South Africa and South Korea bid to stage the event. The field was narrowed down to 2, with France getting the nod ahead of South Korea from the FIFA Executive Committee. Staying in Zurich, the 2022 FIFA World Cup will be staged in November and December that year, FIFA confirmed on Thursday. The duration of the tournament will be reduced, with the finals being played on the 18th of December to coincide with Qatar's National Day, FIFA revealed. The World Cup is being shifted from its traditional June-July slot as weather conditions are considered to be too hot for the tournament to be played in Qatar in the middle of the calendar year. Meanwhile, Uganda's Cranes replace Bolivia as guests of the Nigeria Super Eagles in a friendly in Uyo, Akwa Ibom State next Wednesday. The Nigeria Football Federation disclosed in Abuja on Thursday. Bolivia announced their withdrawal from the match earlier this week. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa, wishing you all a sporty weekend.
Because this is Africa. Tamina, for Africa.
I'm very excited.
Because this is Africa. This time for Africa.
Just ahead on the sunny side of sports, VOA's Tef Tef and Downtown Brown will have our English Premier League football question of the week.
The Voice of America. VOA.
Hey, it's VOA's Downtown Brown.
And I'm Tef Tef.
And so the question of the week is, let's celebrate. So the EPL has some weird, funny, and amazing goal celebrations in the past.
And Wayne Rooney's knockout celebration on Sunday at Old Trafford has now been added to that list.
What's your most favorite memorable celebration so far?
And better yet, do you have a celebration of your own? So we had a few people respond to this.
Umar Faruku. He said, my favorite and most memorable celebration is the Tim Cahill.
While my style of celebration when I score is a golf style to my fans.
Is it a putting or is it like a driver kind of shot?
Or a Craig Bellamy type of golfing.
Happy Gilmore swing. So next, Tef, you got one?
Well, my favorite comment, which is also one of my favorite celebrations, was by Adione Prosper Ifeanyi. And that was last year when Samuel Eto'o celebrated like an old man holding his back at a BPL match when Mourinho had just said that, you know, some of his players are a little too old. So that's definitely one of my favorite ones. And he's African, so shout out to Eto'o.
And next we're going to Namdi, who said, when it comes to celebrations, I always remember Kaká pointing his fingers at the sky.
Yep, that's a really good one too, yeah. When he's played for AC Milan, he was pretty good. Okay, so going to your celebrations, Oku commented saying that he likes to celebrate doing a dance called the Etigi dance. I actually went up and YouTubed and looked it up. I tried it a couple of times. It didn't come out as well as I thought. But I'm sure you do it way better than we do.
I don't think you're a good dancer anyways.
I don't think so either. So I'll spare you the pain of that. But he says he kisses his left foot because he's a natural left footer. And yeah, he celebrates doing the Etigi dance. So, well, kudos to you. Do you have a favorite one, Dan?
My favorite one is a classic. It was Michael Jackson, the Thriller, you know, when he acts like a zombie. And it's Thriller.
If you get your teammates behind you.
Behind me, everyone would be like, oh, that's amazing. So, Tef, what's yours?
Mine is very subtle, man. I don't think I have any good ones. But I do like the point of your shirt. You know, let the fans read your name, especially when it's a solo effort. You know,
gotcha.
Simple, but says it all.
So key matchups for this weekend. We have Liverpool versus Man U, Newcastle versus Arsenal. But the main matchup we want to talk about is, I know it's not EPL, but it's Real Madrid versus Barcelona. They played them last time and Barcelona won. So we're going to talk about who do you think is going to be X factor in that game and give me some predictions.
Coming off their performance against Man City, I think Barcelona has a good chance. I would like to see Real Madrid at least win and somewhat take control of La Liga again. They've been in such a bad form lately, and then there's like team problems with Cristiano and Bale.
Because I remember, but Real Madrid was on fire. And now they're slowly just dying down.
Yep.
So you never know if Real Madrid can just, they're 1 point behind, so you never know if Real Madrid can just stop what they're doing and just, let's be all seriousness and just get back on top.
But you can guarantee that it's going to be a really good match. It's, you know, it's a deciding match. It's not like, you know, one team is up by like 6 points or, you know, 12 points. This is actually, you know,
it's like going down to the wire.
Exactly.
So, for next week, we have
We wanted to discuss this issue of EPL teams not being able to make it to the quarterfinals of the Champions League. So we want to hear from you guys. You know, do you think that EPL teams are weak in Europe? Do you think it has anything to do with, you know, the toughness of the competition at home? But either way, it's just a really bad year for Premier League teams in the Champions League. And so do you still think that the EPL is the best league in the world, or are there other leagues kind of, you know, taking over?
So we like to hear comments on Facebook, on Sonny's page, on facebook.com/VOA Sonny. Stay tuned for Tuesday for the question of the week. And I'm VOA's Downtown Brown.
And I'm Tef.
Have a great weekend, you guys. VOA!
Friends, we can all listen to the Sunny Side of Sports.
Yes, my friend.
I'm Sonny Young in Washington, and you're listening to the Sunny Side of Sports on the Voice of America.
Voice of America!
Finally, Friday's draw for the UEFA Champions League quarterfinals to be played over two legs. Atletico Madrid versus defending champion Real Madrid, a rematch of the 2014 final. Paris Saint-Germain meets Barcelona, Porto plays Bayern Munich, and Juventus takes on Monaco. First leg matches will be played April 14th and April 15th, and the return legs on April 21st and April 22nd. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports. Back to Yahaeus Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny, and listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays like today, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 hours UTC. Right here on the Voice of America.
Coming up, Boko Haram distributing leaflets warning people to boycott the March 28th Nigerian nationwide elections. And next, Guinea-Bissau's ability to handle the Ebola epidemic assessed. But first, some music. Here is Burkina Faso's Ja Verite with Bekasso.
Bye.
to hitting bara. I like it thunder. I like his utara. Brema bobo e boo. Bobo you la so. Brema bobo e boo. Lahara. Bobo you la so. Tu deviens tout houpo, tu deviens tout nouveau. Ça va vous nous m'avez popo. Bibi, menya chamana mole chakila. Kunya mogalou, personne te cligne. Sol, ni sera popo. Iye, popo kalou fonye. Moroya be popo. Ça va vous nous m'avez popo. La moya be popo, la hora, popo julato, beka so be hanya so, mona dorato, popo julato, la hora, popo julato, beka so, hanya so, mona dorato, popo julato, la hora, ya la fraternite, la solidarite, de convivialité. Big Martin for you, Tandy for you, Bertin for you, Sidoni for you, Emmanuel for you, Radio Parafon for you, Yakuli Palice for you, Kusube for you, Marukanazwe for you, Jagini Baha for you, Stefano Sanu for you, Sanu Lafina for you, Halizata Kando for you, Kamora for you, Kadafi for you, Umarukanazwe for you.
Burkina Faso's Ja Verite with Bekasso.
Well, in northeast Nigeria, insurgent group Boko Haram has distributed leaflets warning people to boycott the March 28th nationwide elections. But that is not the only threat to security. VOA's Anne Look reports people are moving their families away from sites of possible tension around the country and are preparing for unrest once results are announced.
From the Niger Delta to the far northeast, the pre-election period has become a time of migration for some Nigerians. VOA met several on the streets of Kaduna.
My wife has been pestering me for the past 3 months. Even today she called to say, are we ready to move?
Nobody wants to die for nothing. So I myself, I'm even planning to relocate to a certain part of Kaduna where I will not be hearing sound of war, drums of crisis, burning of tires and tear gas and all those kind of stuff. I don't want to see all those rubbish.
If before the elections they are already tearing posters, you know, burning cars,
injuring people and already being violent before the election, that anything can happen either during or after the elections.
Nigeria's last nationwide vote in 2011 was praised as more credible than any before it. But more than 1,000 people were killed, most of them during post-election violence, and mostly in Kaduna State, where politics sparked sectarian and communal tensions. The 2015 elections are shaping up to be the most hotly contested in Nigeria's democratic history. President Goodluck Jonathan and the ruling PDP party are facing a strong challenge from the opposition APC and its candidate, former military ruler Muhammadu Buhari. Voters are nervous about the post-election period.
We'll take our time, we'll go and vote, and we'll stay back and inside our houses, and we'll look on how the election and the outcome of it will be. But certainly we have to go and vote.
Nigeria's police chief issued a statement this month trying to reassure voters and calling for them to stop relocating. But the pre-election incidents have been piling up. Party headquarters have been bombed or vandalized. Opposition supporters say they have been attacked in Rivers State. A suicide bomber blew herself up in Gombe as President Goodluck Jonathan finished his rally there. Nigeria's National Human Rights Commission says at least 58 people have been killed in pre-election violence since December. Lagos, Kaduna, and Rivers State, it says, have had the most incidents. Nigeria's Electoral Commission postponed the polls by 6 weeks to March 28th after security forces said they needed more time to fight Boko Haram in the northeast and ensure voting is safe. And look, VOA News, Dakar.
A team from the International Medical Corps recently wrapped up a week in Guinea-Bissau where they assessed the country's ability to handle a potential Ebola patient. Sean Casey, the group's regional director for Ebola response, tells Ricky Shryock that Guinea-Bissau has a coordination structure in place, but it has not become real action on the ground.
I think the biggest weakness right now is just not enough experienced people on the ground to roll things out, to actually action the decisions that are made.
And when you talk about experienced people, you also mean people who would necessarily work in an ETU or, for instance, the burial teams or contact tracers. You mentioned there are no burial teams trained.
There are no burial teams that are ready right now. The WHO recently did an evaluation to see how far along Guinea-Bissau is in preparedness on certain kind of core activities. Burial teams, they had 0% of the necessary preparedness actions. That's a huge gap, but you need people to come in and provide that training. The training needs to be done in Portuguese. Materials need to be translated.
I think a couple months ago, there was an issue of testing the blood. An Ebola suspect case needs the blood to be tested as soon as possible, obviously, to confirm whether it's Ebola or not. Last time I was talking to them, they said that it would come to Dakar at the Institut Pasteur, but that could take 3 or 4 days. What's the length of time it might take to get a suspected case tested?
Right, so the process is you have a suspect case that's alerted, probably by a health worker. They call the Central Ministry of Health, which would dispatch a team to go and do a blood draw. The blood would then be transported by land to Institut Pasteur in Dakar. That whole process, from identifying the case, making sure that the person actually meets case definition, drawing blood, transporting it, could take several days. And then the results, getting the results back, would once the samples are received, you're talking about probably several hours to turn it around. There is a lab that's going to be brought in by the Portuguese, a mobile lab that's going to be set up apparently in the next few weeks.
And why by land? Why wouldn't they fly the sample?
There's issues around safety of flying samples and just allowability to do that. I don't think the government in Senegal will actually allow samples to be flown in.
To be clear, there have been no cases in Guinea-Bissau up to now. Why have there been no cases, do you think? What is Guinea-Bissau's relationship to the rest of the countries in the region that do have Ebola cases?
Right, so you can only have an Ebola case, really, if you have a person with Ebola that comes into the country. There's not a huge amount of travel between affected areas in Guinea or Senegal that would go into Bissau. The border areas with Guinea-Bissau have not seen a significant number of cases, which is probably why there haven't been any cases in Bissau. It's really just a matter of luck.
Sean Casey is Regional Director for Ebola Response at International Medical Corps. He was speaking to Ricky Shryock from Dakar, Senegal. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Peter Hundley, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Years of political unrest have roiled Egypt's economy and caused instability that resulted in foreign investors pulling out, which worsened the problem, and over time, the situation snowballed. Today, in order to rise out of the morass, the country's economy needs an influx of some $200 to $300 billion in foreign investment. So, in an effort to make Egypt more attractive to investors, President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi launched significant reforms to kickstart the economy and improve the business climate. These include cutting income tax rates, establishing new mechanisms to resolve commercial disputes, and passing a new law providing new incentives and legal protections for investment. All of these things are key to attracting new investment, said Secretary of State John Kerry at the Egypt Economic Development Conference, which took place in mid-March in the Egyptian Red Sea resort of Sharm el-Sheikh. Everybody knows that money, capital, behaves in fairly predictable ways, and those who make decisions about investment look for certainty. They look for confidence. They look for the knowledge that, if they invest, what they're investing in will be a transparent and accountable transaction. The United States believes that as the region's most populous country, Egypt has a crucial impact on the entire region. So a stable, prosperous Egypt means a stable, prosperous region. That is why the U.S. invests in Egypt, about $2.2 billion worth, or 20% of all direct foreign investment. We are providing economic assistance in the hundreds of millions of dollars that will be directed to small business enterprises and to new startups because we want to see a sustainable economy grow in Egypt, said Secretary of State Kerry. It is strategically important to this region and to all of us who are looking for stability and for a better standard of living and greater inclusivity and participation by citizens. It is important to make certain that Egypt can move along the road to development and to the full achievement of its democratic aspirations. And that's something the United States will remain committed to.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.
Celebrate the sounds of Africa today, yesterday, and tomorrow. That's our mission in your show, Music Time in Africa. Hello, I'm your host, Heather Maxwell. Join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC and discover the best Pan-African music in the world. We play it all right here, only the best on VOA Africa.
As Nigeria heads to the polls March 28th, Voice of America reporters head to the field, covering the election campaigns and the issues for Nigeria and all of Africa. turn to Voice of America for the facts. Nigeria Decides 2015. What happens there matters throughout Africa. VOA has the largest team of international journalists in Nigeria and surrounding countries, counting down to the March 28th election and beyond. VOA's Nigeria Decides 2015 coverage is on radio with Daybreak Africa, Africa News Tonight, and Nightline Africa. On television with Africa 54 and Straight Talk Africa. And stay on top online. Go to voanews.com.